The Pat Kenny Show
with Mater Private Network
on News Talk.
Latest Ross O'Carroll Kelly book is hitting the shelves. Once Upon a Time in Donnybrook is the title. The author, of course, is Paul Howard. Good morning, Paul.
Good morning.
Paul, can I personally thank you for the love scene in this book, from which I don't think I will ever recover?
Is a love scene too generous to describe?
It's quite something. I'll never look at Canterbury Gear the same way again.
Well, there's an award that's given out every year to the novelist that writes the worst or the most cringe-inducing
bedroom dead scene. Cert.
And I've wanted that award for 15, 20 years. And every book, I raise the stakes with an even cringier bedroom scene. And I'm glad you brought that up at the beginning of the interview.
Oh, yeah. Let's be clear. If you don't win it with this one, I really don't want to imagine what comes out in the next book. Did at any point as you wrote the first draft of it, did you look and think, maybe I shouldn't?
The thing with love scenes I've always found is don't write a second draft. Because if you read it back with a view to rewriting it, you're going to... You will take fright and tone everything down. So that's one of those scenes where, yeah, I sort of went for it. And you read the result. And if it made you feel that way,
It's quite something. It's quite something. The book is, this is number 22?
This is the 22nd in the Ross O'Carroll Kelly series, yeah. And 22nd in 22 years, so in the series of novels.
How do you keep track of the, I think, what Marvel and DC would call the Ross O'Carroll Kelly universe?
Well, I have this wonderful editor called Rachel Pierce, and she has an encyclopedic knowledge and memory of every story I've ever written and every joke I've ever cracked. And God bless her, because if it wasn't for her, I would be rewriting scenes that I've already written before. So sometimes if I crack a joke, she'll say, I like that, but I think that's actually in book 7. And she's able to say that. So that's how I keep track of it. I mean, I do have sort of some vague sense of who everybody is and where they've gone, where they've been. The difficulty for me is that I do the sort of two Ross worlds, actually three Ross worlds. There's the books, there's the weekly column, and there's the plays. And they've all gone off in different directions, probably about 12 or 13 years ago. And I don't know how to bring them all together again. So sometimes I think Ross is at a certain point in the books where he's not actually, he's there in the column. So for instance, there was a point a few years ago where Ross had two children in the columns and five children in the books, because he'd had triplet sons called Brian, Johnny and Leo, which is not an accident, by the way. And but I'd totally forgotten this. I didn't want to put any spoiler alerts into the Irish Times column, but it was in the book. So I thought, well, it's time, when they were about 3 years of age, I thought it's time to introduce them to the column. So I just sort of subtly dropped them in one weekend. And I discovered that weekend that the books and the columns have completely different readerships, because people were so confused. They said, Who are these triplets? Where have they come from?
Really?
How have they got to 3 years of age without me hearing about them? Yeah.
So do you think at some point, a bit like Einstein looking for the general theory that would cohere everything, will there be a moment at which all of the universes will synthesize?
I don't know. I wouldn't over-intellectualize it, because I don't know if I could ever bring them together again. It's like they've just gone off in completely different dimensions at this stage.
And do you see Ross, or do you imagine Ross as an individual separate to you? Like, if I asked you, how will he react to a certain set of scenarios? What's his thinking on such? Do you just know him as a person, or is he, every time you sit down at the typewriter, you just come up with him afresh?
Yeah, no, I think at this stage the difficulty for me is not getting his voice into my head, it's getting his voice out of my head. And especially when I'm writing a book like this book, I work long days. So, you know, this book was written over the course of 3 months, where I'm working sort of 8 to 10 hour days with Ross's voice in my head all the time. So
it's not healthy for a man, Paul.
It's not, you know, and this is what I do for a living. But yeah, I know what Ross thinks about any particular subject, but at the end of the day, I might not know what I think about a particular subject.
It must be tricky as well, though, to get that fine balance. I mean, I know it's a bit of an extreme analogy, but the kind of Tony Soprano thing of creating a character who is laden with reprehensible behaviours that everybody loves. Because Ross is not a nice person.
No, I think he has I think there's some sense of a moral compass in him that's working. I think he, you know,
has its moments.
He does have his moments, you know, and I think, you know, his relationship with his children. He clearly loves his children, and sometimes completely by accident, he's a good father to them. You know, often by accident. As his parents get older, I think he's connecting more and more with them, and he sees them getting older, and I think that's bringing out a different side of Ross as well. But yeah, I mean, that's the challenge for me, because I hated Ross, and I hated people. You know, the first few books were born out of rage about Ross O'Carroll Kelly type people, and I didn't see the world from that point of view. And I suppose the longer I went on, you couldn't write about a character for 22 years without having some kind of empathy for him, without having, you know, without seeing the world from his point of view. And I suppose he's this kid who, you know, he's born into the world. His dad tells him he's going to be the greatest rugby player who ever lived when he's like 3 years of age. His mother isn't bothered by him. He's sent to this school where he's told he's essentially the second coming of Christ because he can play rugby. And then he wins the school's cup, but nothing happens after that.
Does it need to, though, after that?
Well, yeah, but or does it? And that's what's sort of kept me going writing Ross. It's like, what happens to this kid when he's prepared for this lifetime of glory and stardom and all the rest? And his life sort of falls off a cliff. It never gets better than it was at 18 years of age. But yeah, I mean, I suppose the job for me with every book is, how do I make people pull for him? Like, how he's always in 7 or 8 tricky situations, as he is in Once Upon a Time in Donnybrook. He's made a mess of his life. The pieces are all over the place. It's like a plate spinning act. He's trying to keep all these plates going and stop them falling. But the challenge for me is, how do I get people to read the story and say, I want this guy to win. I don't want him to fail here.
Aside from Ross, how do you remain so prolific? Because as we speak, we have the Copperface Jacks, the musical is just
closed,
run in Cork.
Yeah.
We have that. You have the kids' books. You have the Ross series. You have the Ross series in the newspaper. You have the Ross plays. And you have the serious works like the Guinness biography.
Yeah.
Like, it's a huge compendium of stuff.
Well, sometimes I'm working on things for... you know, for a long time, like the Guinness, the Tara Brown autobiography, I worked on it for 10 years. And then when it comes out within a month of a Ross book, it does look like I've been busy. But I manage my time well. I think that's the answer. I get up really early in the morning. I'm a 5 o'clock riser.
And do you treat it as a day job? Sit down, punch the clock?
I gave up full-time journalism 17 years ago, and it was supposed to be a 2-year sabbatical. That was the plan, and I never went back. And pretty much everything that's happened in my career since then has been an accident. I just sort of kind of bundle from one thing to the next. But I always treated it as work. I never treated it like I'd kind of gone into semi-retirement when I started working for myself. And so, yeah, I get up. I'm quite disciplined. I'm fortunate in the sense that, you know, there's owls and larks in the world, and I'm a lark. I've always been an early riser, and I get up at 5. I'm usually working by, you know, 5:20. And if I can keep going, I'll work until 5 or 6 in the evening. So I do long days.
So you do 12-hour days writing?
Yeah, often I do. Yeah, yeah.
Do you write to a word count per day?
No, I mean, every day will... Some days will disappoint you. It's like, you know, it's like playing golf, I think. You know, some days will just frustrate the hell out of you. You'll get 300 or 400 words written, and some days you'll get 3,000 words written. But the strange thing is, there's some days you get 3,000 words written and you know they're not 3,000 good words. And then you might have one day where you have a problem with a plot, as I had in this book, and I solved it in a day. And I think I wrote 200 words. But I felt that was probably the best day's work I had done on this book.
Do you trust your own judgment? Somerset Maugham had that line that says the job of the author is to kill their darlings, to find the bits that they love and say, that's self-indulgent. Do you have somebody else tell you that went too far, or can you judge it?
Rachel, my editor, has been my editor since the very, very first Ross book. So I trust her judgment. But Rachel is never telling me that's gone too far. Rachel is generally telling me you need to go a little bit further in that.
Even with the love scene that we mentioned.
With the love scene, yeah. It's actually quite embarrassing when you meet your editor. I know an author friend of mine told me he wrote a love scene once in a novel. He's a crime writer and he wrote a love scene and he met his editor and she said to him over dinner, really sheepishly, I see there's a bedroom scene in this novel. And he said, yeah, what did you think? And she just said, don't do that again.
I noticed as well, by the way, you regretted, I was reading an interview by you where you said that one of the regrets that you had out of the entire Ross O'Carroll Kelly series was that you sent his old man, I nearly said, sent his father to jail.
Yeah.
Because you, in hindsight, felt the father would have got away with it.
Of course he would. Of course he would. You know, there's actually a scene, I don't want to give any spoilers away, in this book where Ross gets into trouble with the law, and the thing going into the next book is going to be, you know, what's Ross going to get? What kind of sentence is he going to get? And, you know, right now I kind of feel like he'll get the sentence that Charles should have got, which is that the judge, or his barrister will say, you know, this is a man from an impeccable family, which usually means middle class. And he had an excellent background, which generally means a rugby schooling.
Right. Every opportunity not to be where he currently is. It is, as always, another remarkable piece of work in the series. It is titled Once Upon a Time in Donnybrook. It is the 22nd in the Ross O'Carroll Kelly series. Congratulations, as always, Paul. Lovely to talk to you. The author,
likewise,
of course.
Anton. Thanks so much.
Paul Harris.
The Pat Kenny Show.
With Matter Private Network.
Weekdays at 9 a.m. on News Talk.